Hello and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
These city attorneys blindsided us.
The Democratic National Convention is 2 weeks away, but some groups are still negotiating a protest route with the city.
I believe we should have term limits for Supreme Court justices of the United States as well.
Term limits and mandatory ethics rules for Supreme Court justices. A look at President Biden's proposed reforms.
I wanted to understand how adoption was actually functioning in the lives of the people that were most impacted by it.
And a new book explores the politics of adoption. And now to some of today's top stories. Mounting recession fears were just part of the reason for a massive drop in the Dow today, more than 1,000 points, making it the biggest daily percentage loss in 2 years. The NASDAQ and S&P 500 both closed the day in negative territory, and globally, Japan's Nikkei index had its worst rout in history. Economists say the U.S. economy remains strong, but it added fewer jobs in July than expected at 114,000. Also, there's concern that the Federal Reserve failed to act promptly enough and fears that big bets on AI may not pay off. A coalition of groups looking to protest outside the Democratic National Convention, that's in 2 weeks, is pushing back on the city's proposed route. The groups known as the Coalition to March on the DNC were in court again today, advocating for a longer route than the one you see here. Coalition says more than 200 organizations across the country are planning to join them in Chicago for the DNC.
We know that a protest of 10,000 people takes up longer than 1 mile. And if we can get 20,000 on our own in Chicago, then we definitely will have tens of thousands if they're coming from all across the Midwest and all across the country even. And there's no way that 1.1 miles will accommodate those people.
The coalition says it has instead pitched this route, the one you see on your screen. The group's attorney says he expects a ruling this week. And just in time for the DNC, Westside commuters have a shiny new L station at Lake Street and Damon Avenue.
From the grand stairs and escalator visible through the glass facade and the incredible mural, every detail has been thoughtfully considered to enhance the passenger experience and create a vibrant addition to this community.
City officials today cut the ribbon on the newly reopened Damon Green Line station that had been closed since 1948. The city says the station fills a 1.5-mile service gap between Ashland and California. The $80 million TIF-funded station includes a glass bridge connecting inbound and outbound train platforms, as well as a grand stair and escalator. Up next, a bold plan to reshape the nation's highest court, right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
President Joe Biden's proposal calling for Supreme Court reform is already receiving some major pushback. Some of it comes from current Justice Neil Gorsuch, who advised the president in a recent interview to, quote, be careful. In addition to targeting recent court decisions on presidential immunity, Biden's proposal would also address term limits for justices and a mandatory ethics rule. Here to talk more about the proposal are Harold Krent, a law professor at the Illinois Institute of Technology's Chicago-Kent College of Law, William Howell, a professor in American politics at the University of Chicago, and David Applegate, an attorney and member of the conservative and libertarian legal organization, the Federalist Society. Gentlemen, thank you all for joining us. First, let's get your reaction, to this plan. What do you make of it, first of all? Harold Krent, I'll start with you, please.
Well, I don't think anything's going to happen soon. So this is setting the agenda for the future. It's suggesting that the party should be alert to the fact that the public has lost confidence in the integrity and the independence of the Supreme Court. A lot of reasons for that maybe we can get into later. But it is setting the agenda, and I think it's possible that there would be a coalition of Republicans, Democrats down the road that could at least agree to the term limits part of the proposal.
William Howell?
I agree. Look, when Biden ran 4 years ago for office, it was under the promise to restore some stability to our democracy, to shore up our institutions, and he set that work aside for the most part while president. And so it's late in his term, he's putting it front and center. The work of institutional reform is not the work of one administration. It's really the work of a generation. It requires a lot of coalition building, a lot of stage setting. I think it's healthy for our politics. I'm glad to see it. It's coming late in his term.
David Applegate.
I agree with Harold and Bill that this is not going to happen anytime soon. My own take on this is that it's unnecessary, that the attacks on the court are largely because people are not happy. People of the administration and his supporters are not happy with some of the Supreme Court decisions. And it is those attacks on the integrity of the court that are undermining faith in the court. I don't think these proposals are necessary. I do think there is some potential bipartisan support for term limits for the justices, but it may be a little known fact that the Supreme Court actually does have a written code of conduct on which all nine justices signed off last November that puts in writing out there for public view the code of conduct that they have largely followed for generations.
Harold Krent, to that point, if the Supreme Court already has a code of ethics that justices are supposed to be following, do you think we need a new one? Why might we need a new one?
Well, obviously the disclosures about Justice Thomas and Alito in particular have scandalized at least part of the populace, and they don't think that the members of the Supreme Court should take money for free and then decide cases that affect the interests of those whom they've taken vacations with. And there is, at the minimum, an appearance of a conflict of interest. And that's something that should have been avoided by the court. It wasn't. And so if the justices are going to thumb their nose at this kind of written ethics rule, then maybe Congress has to do something more stringent. They've exempted the Supreme Court in past ethics determinations, so they've bound lower court judges. Maybe they should increase it, enhance it, and to cover the Supreme Court justices as well.
David, is imposing an additional code of ethics, is that even constitutionally allowed?
My own view is that it does not. It infringes on the separation of powers. The distinction between the lower court judges is that those judges are creations of Congress. The Constitution itself creates the Supreme Court and sets the terms of their behavior. So I don't think that Congress constitutionally has power to act here, and I believe it would lead to unnecessary conflicts between the legislative branch and the judicial branch, which then, of course, the judicial branch would have to decide.
William Howell, do you think these reforms are politically motivated? As we heard from David, some folks have been unhappy with decisions that the court has made, and we can name several of those. Is this a reaction to that?
In some ways, sure. It always is the case that arguments about institutional reforms are informed by whose axe is being gored, who stands politically to benefit. That is true. But there nonetheless are real reasons to think about the need for reforming our institutions. When it comes to term limits, which is, to my mind, the real lead here, for the most part, there are strong arguments against it. When you think about term limits for governors or mayors, the willingness of people to step forward and run for these offices and the incentives that that term limits create, for the most part, are bad. I think most political scientists would come out and not get behind them. When we're talking about an 18-year term limit at the Supreme Court justice level, though, those concerns attenuate quite a bit. And the big benefit that would come out of this kind of intervention, to my mind, is it would regularize the appointment process. That is, presidents would routinely be able to count on being able to make two appointments to the court. And right now, it's by accident who has one, three, four, none. And this won't do, given just how involved the Supreme Court is in all manner of policymaking.
Because as it stands right now, we're often waiting on a Supreme Court justice to either decide to resign while they are able to do so, or they die on the bench. What does the Constitution currently say about how long a Supreme Court justice serves?
So there's
Harold?
The Constitution guarantees lifetime appointment. And so we would require a constitutional amendment for this to go through. We had a constitutional amendment to change term limits for presidents. So I think there's a lot of good reasons, which Professor Howell suggested, is that, we too decide to regularize the appointment process, make sure it's even over time. And, there's problems with someone in office for over 18 years. There's a huge fight now with a judge in the lower court one step below who's 95, and she's sued the entire rest of the court because they think it's time for her to step down, and she thinks not. And it's ugly, and who knows, gets into the merits of that. But this is just a sound mechanism for going forward.
Here's where I really want to disagree with both my colleagues here, which is that this would not solve the purported problem. Number one, a justice could die, resign, or retire short of 18 years and do that for purely political reasons. Just as Stephen Breyer...
Of course, they can't die for political reasons, but resign or retire.
Absolutely. Just as Justice Breyer stepped down so that President Biden could appoint his successor on his watch, this would, in my opinion, exacerbate the problem because now you have... presidents knowing exactly when somebody would be up, somebody else could step down. A two-term president could appoint 4 out of 9 justices, and then presuming that president had the Senate in his favor, could have 2 more justices step down and confirm 2 more and thereby have 6 out of 9. The other problem is that this whole argument presumes that the court is supposed to be a policy-making body, and it is not. It's not a mini-legislature, no matter how much we talk about who voted which way, where judges are supposed to say, yeah, I vote for this result, I vote for this result. The court is supposed to decide cases in accordance with the facts and the law.
But it routinely does behave like a policy-making body. It engages and intervenes in all manner of policy disputes. And so if we want to think about how the appointments proceed, having it be regularly tied in one way or another. I mean, so I think that these concerns about strategic retirements are important to keep in mind, but holding out the role that they ought to play without an right. eye towards what they actually do when thinking about the institution that defines how the appointments make is
But my is point is that we should not succumb to the notion that this is a political body that's going to make decisions for us. We should get back to deciding.
And one of the realities.
Should get back to letting we the people decide what the law is through the legislature, let the executive enforce it, and let the judiciary decide the cases.
We don't disagree with that, but one of the problems with this court
I think you fundamentally do.
It is trying to increase its own agenda. It has taken active steps to make sure that they can decide cases they want to decide, and so they're acting more in a partisan manner, which I think exacerbates the public's concern. So I think the 18-year term limit, it's not going to take care of everything. We agree with that, but it's certainly a step in the right direction. And if it does help the stature of the judiciary, that's all for the good.
David, if there is an external code that is imposed on the Supreme Court, they still would have the final say. So I'm moving over to sort of like the code of ethics versus obviously the term limits. The Supreme Court would still have the final say on whether or not Congress's decision to impose said code of ethics or said requirement is even constitutional. What might that look like when it comes down to it?
I mean, to me, that would be virtually farcical. You tell me. This is what I have to agree to, and I say you have no power to agree to that, so I'm going to ignore it. I mean, it's very much now like the administration deciding it's not going to abide by a Supreme Court decision on student loan forgiveness and look for ways to get around it. That simply undermines faith in our institutions, and I believe that Congress trying to impose a code of ethics on the court, which the court could then disregard, would further undermine faith in the institution, which all three of us, I think, would like to see upheld.
Would you like to see the Supreme Court itself come up with a more robust set of civics code?
Well, I just reread the code that was adopted November 13th of last year, and it looks pretty rigorous to me.
So we're well and good right now in terms of the court's behavior in office.
Because our justices are honoring the code that they've written for themselves.
Well, what has happened is that this code has come out partly in response to some of the things that you gentlemen have brought up. And I think it's John Roberts' way of admonishing Justice Thomas in particular, not so much Justice Alito. I think this whole flag controversy is a tempest in a teapot. But I think this is John Roberts' way of putting his hand down and saying, look, guys, we have got to get this right. If we don't, we have bigger problems.
All right. That is where we'll have to leave it. I'm sure there's a lot more to talk about with this issue going forward. I thank the three of you for such a robust discussion. Harold Krent, William Howell, and David Applegate. Thanks, everybody. Up next, a look at the U.S. adoption industry in a conversation recorded earlier. Stay with us. Of the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision, many anti-abortion advocates offered adoption as a suitable solution to unwanted pregnancies. But the author of a new book says that argument is misguided. In Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and Privilege of American Motherhood, author and sociologist Gretchen Sisson tells the stories of birth mothers who place their infants for domestic adoption, painting a far more nuanced image of the adoption industry than most people understand. And joining us now is author Gretchen Sisson, author of Relinquished. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So first, tell us why you wanted to write this book.
Yeah. So I started doing data collection for this book back in 2010, obviously well before we knew the Dobbs decision was coming down the pipe. But at that point, I was in graduate school. I was working at an organization that worked with pregnant and parenting teenagers and young people. And I was looking at the ways that our cultural ideas of parenthood and of what young parenthood meant really diverged from their lived experiences. And I was also doing some work in abortion care and funding and seeing the ways that those cultural narratives diverged from what we were hearing from our callers. And I wanted to understand how adoption was actually functioning in the lives of the people that were most impacted by it. So that's what brought me to that research in 2010. And then I did 10-year follow-up with a lot of the same women that I had interviewed the first time around. And then the Dobbs decision happened and took what was kind of a smaller academic question and gave a new political framing and resonance for it to be able to speak directly to what the justices were talking about in the oral arguments and the decision.
You tell many stories of biological or birth moms who come from varying backgrounds. What are the common threads that you found among them?
Yeah, so when we look at the commonalities, and they're everything I say as far as commonalities has many exceptions, right? Because this is a really diverse group of women. But for the most part, most of them wanted to parent their children. That's why they continued their pregnancies. They were intending and hoping to parent. And it was really when parenthood felt impossible or untenable because they didn't have the support they needed, they didn't have the resources that they needed to make that possible, that they turned to adoption as a lifeline. So this whole idea that women are choosing between abortion and adoption is just not something that we've seen in how people are actually making decisions about pregnancies and about parenting.
The stories in the book, they're primarily, as you say, focused on women who relinquished infants post Roe versus Wade. But how would you say access to reproductive health care has impacted the adoption industry?
So adoption is primarily a constrained choice. When you take away other options, right, when you make abortion completely inaccessible or when you make parenting very impossible, that's when people turn to adoption. It was no one's first choice, really. And I think that that is really important. So when you talk about limits on abortion access and other types of reproductive health care, that's a constraint that's going to limit the options that people have available to them in a really critical way. But when you also talk about things like ending the child tax credit, right, that is also a constraint on how people think about the options that are available to them.
So, you know, you mentioned the Dobbs decision a couple of times, and so I want to get to, you know, in the wake of that decision, of course, during the presidential campaign, there were many politicians, public figures who, as you say, put adoption and abortion side by side, as if these are two equal alternatives. And we have a clip of former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley on the campaign trail last year.
My husband was adopted, and I am reminded of that blessing every single day. When he was just a few years old, Michael and his siblings were taken from their home. Later, they were put into foster care. It was a rough experience for him. Thankfully, when he was 4 years old, a loving family adopted Michael and his younger sister. It changed their lives. Adoption literally saved them.
In the case of her husband, it's a little bit different. He was adopted after going through the foster system when he was a little bit older versus being adopted as an infant. But what is your reaction to arguments like hers and some that we heard when the Dobbs decision was playing out?
I think my research specifically is on private adoption systems in the United States. But I think more and more, the contributing factors for both public adoption, which is foster care adoption, and private adoption is really poverty. Right, we see that most relinquishing mothers have less than $5,000 of annual personal income. Right, so you're talking about people who are really coming from a place of constraint, as we've talked about, financial struggle when they're making these decisions. We also see that that's disproportionately who's impacted by foster care systems, along with families of color, and particularly Black families. Right, so you have this increased scrutiny and regulation of poor families in the United States because we as a culture do not believe that people who are living in poverty are capable of parenting. And we want to introduce the solution of family separation and the transfer of children as a way of addressing these inequities. So when I hear a story like Nikki Haley's or other stories that have come out of the private adoption system as well, the question for me is always, what support could that family of origin have had to maintain that connection?
And full disclosure for the audience as well, I myself am an adoptive mother too. But you mentioned your research points to the Turnaway study, and it followed 956 women who sought abortions in the U.S., including 160 who ended up giving birth because they were denied an abortion because they were too far along in their pregnancies, according to the policy of the location where they sought care. Only 15 of them, so that's 9%, relinquished their children for adoption. That means 91% of them chose to parent. But that 9% who relinquished their children, that's only about 0.5%, so 0.5% of all American births that lead to adoption. Mm-hmm. What does that say?
Well, it just shows that adoption is never really going to be a meaningful alternative to abortion access in the lives of American women. And when you deny people access to abortions, you're going to have far, far more people that are parenting in circumstances that they didn't plan, that they didn't choose, at a time in their life that's not ideal, with a partner that they don't really want to co-parent with. Whatever the circumstances that were leading them to want the abortion in the first place, they're going to be parenting in those circumstances more than you're going to have people that are actually relinquishing children for adoption. But I should say that 9% of people who are denied care that end up relinquishing actually is a huge increase in the number of private domestic adoptions because the number of people who need abortions is so high compared to the number of private adoptions. So we have about 850,000 to 1 million abortions every year in the United States. These are pre-Dobbs numbers, but they actually haven't gone down in the last 2 years that we've seen. And you only have about 20,000 private domestic adoptions. So even a relatively small proportion of people who are denied access relinquishing means that you're going to have you could have a fairly dramatic increase in the number of private adoptions.
I could talk about this all day because obviously you've got, you know, individual stories of the birth moms that you spoke with as well, some who say they regret their decision to relinquish their children because it is a very difficult one to have had to make. But how would you say, because we're running out of time, but how do you think society should be thinking differently about adoption going forward?
I think we need to think about the ways that we're using adoption and who adoption purports to serve. Right, we have this idea that there are a lot of children that are in need of homes. We actually have far, far more people who want to adopt from the private adoption system than we have children available. And when we talk about making adoption child-centered in some way, we need to be centering what children need and what children need in their families of origin as well, what that means to keep families together and to support them. Because as soon as you center what adoptive or prospective adoptive families want, you're making this about what adults want rather than what about children and families actually need in the United States.
Yeah, there's always that myth if you tell someone you're adopting, they're like, oh, so many babies out there that need good homes, when all babies need good homes, not just those who may or may not be available for adoption. We have to leave it there. Gretchen Sisson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Again, the book is called Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and Privilege of American Motherhood. And we're back to wrap things up right after this. We'll be right back. And that's our show for this Monday night. You can get Chicago Tonight streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and our website, WTTW.com/news. You can also get the show via podcast and the PBS video app. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Our Spotlight Politics team will weigh in on some notable Illinois Republicans endorsing Vice President Kamala Harris. Plus, the Chicago Police Department misses a deadline to launch a study on how officers are deployed. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to recognize its founder and senior partner, Robert Clifford, who ranked number one in the state of Illinois by Super Lawyers Top 10 2024 Illinois Super Lawyers List.